This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time on Melbourne's community radio station 3CR. 2 hours of current affairs with Joan Bartlett. Many ways to connect with 3CR, the old analogue, 8:55 AM, digital radio 3CR, and by ways of the web page 3cr.org.au, you can listen streaming any program for a week and then go to the podcast where you can listen at your leisure. 3cr.org.au to find out how to do that. So enjoy and support independent media in Australia, Radical Radio 3CR. And many thanks to Anne McAllister for her weekly Celtic Folk Show, which begins at 3, ends just before me. And after that, the excellent program done by Law, presented by the Federation of Community Legal Centres. With the decision by the Albanese government to expel the Iranian ambassador to Australia and other members of the official embassy, questions began to be asked about the reasons for this extraordinary decision on the advice of ASIO. One of those with questions was John Lander, who has had experience in the world of foreign affairs with positions in both Iran and China. Then on to Central America and a country which we don't hear a lot about, but which has amazing biodiversity. 6% of the world's biodiversity, with only 0.03% of the landmass. And I'll be speaking with Dr. Sasha Gillizakakis about Costa Rica. While the so-called local government summit on anti-Semitism on the Gold Coast has concluded, journalists and activists prior to that so-called summit held a webinar to discuss the aims and objectives of that summit and what it was intended to achieve for the Zionist cause. Two journalists, a lawyer and a politician about that. And Mr. Kevin Healy, he's recovered from his cold and he's back with us for his week that was.
A week, journalist, and when we saw women protecting the camp sovereignty sacred fire violently attack a gang of black-attired neo-Nazis. Just when we thought the giant minds and courageous men in black may have attacked them, but no. Their leader, Thomas Sewer, assured us they were simply protecting themselves, putting them in the category of the "she hit my fist with her jaw, she kicked my boots with her ribs" category. And Tom's lovely little moustache, I just can't think who it reminds me of, or to be grammatically correct, of whom it reminds me. Due to this bloody awful cold I've had, I missed that Sunday's events, but watching footage and photos, it seemed the coppers were just as disgusted with the National Socialists, because they couldn't even bear to face them, facing the anti-fascists instead, replete with capsicum spray and the usual arsenal of paramilitary weaponry. Because we know the constabulary would have no time for neo-Nazism. Still, the giant and courageous minds in black would have been cheering by week's end as the socialists and the coalition got together to pack no proper papers queue-jumping illegal boat people off to a small impoverished island, which will teach them for having the gall to flee poverty and persecution. The socialists and coalition running their usual dead heat in the who can be more cruel stakes. Better to spend a fortune to frank your heartless credentials than allow desperate people to enjoy the refuge they seek and contribute to the country they hoped might show them some compassion. Still, the brave fascist victims of those violent camp sovereignty women mightn't be 100% happy if some of those banished to Nauru are, wait for it, white. In the depends which side you're on department, the mainstream media and the caring business class hayseed and sheepshit coalition parties are outraged that former state supremo Dan and Screws the Workers socialised with a bunch of autocrats, expressed delightfully and objectively as only the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin can. Victorian Ukrainians disgusted as traitor and screws the workers joins tyrants, including warmonger Vladimir Putin, at military parade in China. Then screaming P1, dictator Dan and the despots. And sure, they're a fine bunch. They seem to miss that delightful Belarus Supremo who rigs elections and persecutes any opposition who was there in all his glory. But be that as it may, Dan mixing with wanted war criminal Vlad does seem to get a slightly different response than when Dan mixes with his very, very, very close friend and another wanted war criminal, Zion Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo. That leads to the same lot's praising Dan, turning the argument, taking the opportunity to rail against those who declare Benjamin a war criminal. And of course, the outrage decry the unelected autocrats, knowing the path to great leaders is the democratic election process, throwing up inspiring examples like Donald Trump or the poor and our very own Anthony. On such matters, since there seems to be a bit of a difference in the coverage of, say, police being murdered and non-police being murdered by police and on deaths in custody. Not that they are murders, because no one is ever charged after an unbiased investigation into themselves by themselves. Meanwhile, our Minister for Being Offensive and Trained Killing, Richard Malls, the bad guys, he of the giant mind, headed for the US of the UN of the US of the world, on the off chance he might run into someone who would talk to him, ready to return with his usual brown tongue, and what luck. The US Ob Secretary for Being Offensive and Trained Killing announced they had had a happenstance meeting, meaning presumably he ran into Richard wandering around aimlessly and hopefully, Richard hoping someone might just line up a meeting between their big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor and our very own Anthony. Alas, poor Richard, another failure. Donald offered the slaughtered, destructed, genocided, starved, non-land, non-people an offer they can't refuse. A few mirrors and beads and piss off and leave your real estate opportunity to real estate opportunists like Donald. In a treacherous lack of appreciation, the non-land, non-people didn't seem all that impressed by the generosity. Ingrates. Already years behind in reaching our 2030 renewables target, or more correctly, spot on to reach our pollution target, as we approve more and more coal and coal and coal and gas and gas and gas to facilitate the transition from coal and gas, Energy Approval Minister Chris Bowen to Capital has hit upon an inspired plan for our mid-30s target we're obliged to announce under the Paris Agreement, which, in turn, has proved such a roaring success in controlling pollution, addressing climate change if there is such a thing. Adopt a flexible target, a range of possibilities in the knowledge there's no way we're going to get there anyway. Brilliance offset slightly by these interfering bloody climate scientists who think they know more than Chris and the responsible big polluters, who reckon Chris's moving target just maybe shouldn't rely quite as much on offsets, on, say, planting a tree at the back of Bali, allowing you to pollute to your heart's content. Science to the fore in Western Troubler, Aussie, where they've just approved a, quote, green iron project using potent greenhouse methane. Green? Well, the WA Environment Pollution Authority said yes, because if the iron was processed in Asia, it would use coal. Perhaps they need to understand that the green in potent greenhouse gas doesn't make it green. But these long-haired, commie, greenie, wooden working and iron, pesky, annoying, anti-progress environmentalists can be so cruel. Take that Bob Brown. Big Supremo Anthony Albanese's hand-picked minister to do over the environment, Murray Swatch the environment's perfidious job, he raved, is to sacrifice the nation's natural resources and heritage to satisfy the blinkered big end of town. Have we heard anything so cruel? Not only an insult to Murray, but to Anthony and to the responsible polluters. Blinkered big end of town. Come on, Bob. They know exactly what they're doing. on the environment in the Credit Where Credit's Due department, top marks to rubbishy corporate Clean Away Your Money, which modestly tells us all it does for the environment, primarily the environment of its bottom line. It so cares that we recall a couple of years ago it was done for unsafe trucks, unsafe for its drivers, the workers it so cares about, and for the environment as they became a toxic waste redistribution service, leaking their contents as they went along. Oh, and also done for rigged scales at dumping sites, which, surprise, surprise, worked in its favour. Well, this week, more exciting news. Supremo Mark Schubert, real name, lost 30% of his bonus just because there had been three workplace deaths and a leap in serious injuries of those workers it so cares about. That's about 500 grand the poor man's lost, or roughly 160 grand per death, or even less if we add all the serious injuries, leaving Mark to battle on with a mere slightly less than 2 million. As a bonus, of course, not his reasonable little salary, only a touch, or well, several hundred touches more than the workers who were killed and injured, but no doubt the caring Clean Away Your board would have passed a resolution to send their condolences to the loved ones. Right, carried. Next, bonuses. But the credit where credit's due bit. Clean Away Your Own not only kills and injures workers. For years, the affected community has been fighting to have the Tullamarine toxic waste dump near the airport cleaned up. Little matters like toxic waste leaching into the waterways and finding their way into the bay, and toxic fumes emanating from the site with claims of high cancer incidence in the environs. But after years and years and years, Clean Away Your keeps avoiding its responsibilities, earning responsible executives like Mark huge bonuses. See, credit where credit's due. It treats its workers it so cares about and the community it so cares about exactly the same. Notice the High Court threw out poor Ben Roberts' Smite the Innocents attempt to appeal against being found a war criminal, bully, disgrace to the uniform in that defamation case we bet he wishes he'd never launched. All rights exhausted, Ben said he accepted the decision. Well, we're not sure he had any other options. Although in his defence, that disgrace to the uniform bit, that's their job, to kill people. In that case, at least someone's rotting in a jail cell, the whistleblower who allowed the war crimes to be exposed. Unlike robo-debt, the government coughing up an extra 550 mil compensation this week, bringing the cost of the public purse thus far to 2.1 billion and a measurable cost to the victims. Yet not one scummo minister nor public servant responsible for the disaster has faced justice. And wonder if a war criminal will ever be charged. In the week that was bad sport sport, as regular AFL revelations confirm, homophobia is definitely not dead in the men's game. The Brain Dead of the Week award to those Adelaide fans Thursday night who booed Collingwood's Isaac Quainer all night. I wasn't aware till then that Quainer was the target of that homophobic slur that saw an Adelaide star suspended, and the crowd blamed the victim. In men's AFL, homophobia is far from dead. That was the week that was Bad Sports Sport Report. The Caring Employer of the Week award, this is always a tough one, there's so many worthy contenders, but this week a romp for the AN Zero for You Bank, planning to sack, or sorry, sadly having to let go hundreds of staff. It's all about efficiency, apparently, and how did the staff find out they were for the chop? Accidentally. Someone pressed the wrong button and, oops, an automated email told shock workers to hand in their company computers. We're sorry, the caring employer sorried. This is not how we intended this to go, and, it said, it doesn't show how we think of our people. Of course not. They really care. Why, they were forced to provide dedicated psychologists for the somewhat shattered accidental recipients. Not how we treat our people. Don't they mean our ex-people? And finally, we'd have to think surely, sadly, having to let them go is a somewhat bigger clue as to what they really think of them and how they treat them. there's got to be better ways to throw the workers you so care about onto the unemployment scrap heap, like not throwing them there in the first place. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Services Australia.
Job service providers from around the country who cut people off their Social Security life support are convening at Hotel Sofitel in Melbourne CBD on September the 17th for a conference and gala. The AUWU and Anti-Poverty Centre invite you to stand in protest at this punitive event of private companies profiting off the poor. Please stand with us at 8:30 a.m. and or 5:30 p.m. to protest this event and their industry. That's September 17th at 25 Collins Street in the city. These subcontracted industries profiting off our poverty have to go. We demand an end to this injustice that is harming those who are already struggling against the system. The AUWU and Anti-Poverty Centre are 3CR supporters.
My voice identifies me, or otherwise say, don't do this now.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Keen to volunteer and make a difference in your community? Join the Belgrave Survival Day Committee and help bring this important event to life. Commit just a few hours each month and be part of a passionate, friendly crew. No experience needed, just a love for community and teamwork. First Nations people are prioritised, but everyone is welcome. Express your interest now at survivalday@gmail.com or check out the Belgrave Survival Day socials for more information.
A 3CR supporter.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had 3 in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Reading from an ABC report. The current Iranian ambassador to Australia is Ahmed Sadegh, who was recently expelled due to Iran's involvement in anti-Semitic attacks in Australia. On the 26th of August, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced the expulsion of the ambassador along with 3 other Iranian officials. This decision was made following assessments by the Australian Securities Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, that Iran orchestrated 2 anti-Semitic attacks on Australian soil, including an arson attack on a kosher deli in Sydney and a fire at the Adas Israel Synagogue in Melbourne. The expulsion of the Iranian ambassador marks a significant deterioration in diplomatic relations between Australia and Iran. The Australian government accused Iran of attempting to undermine social cohesion within the country through these attacks, which were described as extraordinary and dangerous acts of aggression. Following this incident, All Australian diplomats in Tehran have also left the country, and operations at the Iranian embassy in Canberra have been suspended. The situation highlights the ongoing tensions in diplomatic relations and the serious implications of international actions on local communities. And that's the end of the ABC report. But questions are being asked about the conclusions by ASIO regarding Iran and acts of anti-Semitism. To answer these questions, I spoke to someone who knows about this area of government. John Lander worked in the China section of the Department of Foreign Affairs in the lead-up to the recognition of the People's Republic of China in 1972, and on several other occasions in the 1970s and 80s. He was Deputy Ambassador in Beijing from 1974 to 1976, including a couple of stints as Chargé d'Affaires. He was heavily involved in negotiations of many aspects of the early development of Australia-China relations, especially student-teacher exchange, air traffic agreements, and consular relations. He has made numerous visits to China in the years 2000 to 2019. And he is a former ambassador to Iran from 1985 to 1987. My first question to John was, what does this expulsion of an ambassador mean in the context of diplomatic relations between countries? How significant was that?
Well, it's in diplomatic terms, of course, it's extremely significant. Australia has never declared an ambassador persona non grata before. This is a totally unprecedented event in terms of our diplomatic practice. And I think, in my personal opinion, an extremely shameful one.
Can you expand on that?
Well, even when you are at actual war with another country, the historical practice of diplomacy has always meant that the ambassador of the country you're at war with remains in place in order for there to be a channel of communication. Of course, that hasn't always been carried out. There are previous examples, of course, where diplomatic communication has been broken. There have been plenty of them even in recent times. But when you have a pretty flimsy excuse, then the expelling of the ambassador is rather extreme action. And I think there are a number of factors behind it. The first is that Iran is an easy scapegoat. The sequence of events, I think, is quite significant, that Albanese announced that Australia was going to recognise the state of Palestine at the next General Assembly of the United Nations. He was then vehemently criticised by Netanyahu, calling him a weak politician and really being quite insulting. In fact, the attack by Netanyahu on Albanese's statecraft would have been sufficient to have at least reprimanded the Israeli ambassador, which, of course, did not happen. Immediately following the reprimand that Albanese received from Netanyahu, we get the announcement that intelligence from allied sources provided to ASIO shows that there was an Iranian involvement in two anti-Semitic attacks in Australia. And we then take the extreme action of expelling the Iranian ambassador. So it immediately looks like taking an opportunity or creating an opportunity to scapegoat Iran as a sop to Netanyahu. That's the first thing.
When you say allied sources, no one named?
No, they didn't name it. They just said intelligence obtained through allied sources. Now, we know, of course, the allied sources that we get our intelligence from are the Five Eyes, which of course is Britain and the United States in particular. Canada, Australia and New Zealand share the intelligence that's gathered by the British and American intelligence services. There have been many instances in the past where the intelligence provided, particularly from the United States, is shaped, shall we say, in a way to suit the American interests. And since they have neither named the source of the intelligence nor explained the nature of the evidence, it leads one to suspect that this is simply a trumped-up excuse to scapegoat Iran in order to appease Netanyahu and indeed the United States. Of course, the United States was equally opposed to Australia recognising the state of Palestine. So unless and until the Australian government is prepared to actually provide to the general public actual concrete evidence, then one has to remain suspicious, particularly because the guy in Sydney who was arrested for the attack on the restaurant in Sydney stated quite vehemently that he had had no contact with anyone from the Iranian embassy or representing any Iranian authorities. The people who engaged him to carry out that attack, he did not identify, but he said none of them was Iranian. And in the case of the burning of the synagogue in Melbourne, it's, again, a cause for a great deal of scepticism, because the synagogue in question was the synagogue for the anti-Zionist Jewish community. And there was a great deal of speculation when the firebombing occurred that it was actually done by agents of Zionists and the Zionist lobby rather than any anti-Semitic group. Nothing in it stacks up, and it's particularly suspicious to me. I mean, I have, from my time in Iran when I was ambassador there, personal experience of the religious tolerance in Iran. Iran has a significant, not extremely large, but nevertheless significant Jewish population with 35 synagogues in Iran, most of which are in Tehran. The Jewish community in Iran is fully respected by the authorities, as indeed are the Christians and the Zoroastrians and other religious groups. I was instrumental in bringing three Australian bishops into Iran to consecrate a new bishop of the Anglican Church of Iran, and the Iranian authorities could not have been more helpful. They went out of their way to treat the visiting Australian bishops as VIPs and to facilitate the ceremony and so on. So the idea that the Iranians, having a perfectly good Jewish target in their midst, would come all the way to Australia to attack a Jewish target seems to me to be a bit lacking in credibility as well. The Iranian government isn't anti-Semitic. It is anti-Zionist, and it has nothing against Jews or the Jewish religion or any aspect of Jewish culture. They always honour the Jewish feast days in Iran. Of course, the Jewish community has guaranteed seats in the democratically elected parliament. So there are Jewish representatives of the Jewish community sitting in the parliament, basically part of those responsible for making the laws in Iran, which are, of course, passed by the parliament. But there's not a lot of logic to arguing that Iran would have engineered an anti-Semitic attack in Australia, since they're not anti-Semitic in their own country. The other point, I think, which is extremely important, is that it seems to me like a softening up process. getting the Australian public willing to accept the argument that that Australia must support the United States and Israel in relaunching the war against Iran. See, I would expect that in the next couple of months, we will see a resumption of the Israelis and the Americans bombing Iran. And the pretext will be that Iran has been engaging in these so-called anti-Semitic attacks in other countries. Look at Australia, for instance. Of course, our government will be telling us that it's incumbent upon Australia to join with America in combating the evils of anti-Semitism. And that will drag us into another conflict in the Middle East, which, of course, is preparatory or is part of the long-term process of attempting to contain China. Iran is a key link in the BRICS system, the BRICS organization of cooperating countries. BRICS originally stood for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. There are two more I's have been added as full members. That's Iran and Indonesia. And it's no coincidence that we can see disruptive activities against both of the two new eyes in BRICS, Iran and Indonesia. The rioting in Indonesia that we've seen over the last week or so has been traced back to American financial support for these dissident groups that have been rioting. I can't give you chapter and verse in detail now. I would need to be reading from articles that have been published by other people, but the research that went into identifying the American financiers of the dissident groups in Indonesia is very, very solid. So the long-term aim against the so-called principal threat to the United States, China, is to disrupt China's connections with the rest of the world and to attempt to contain China by breaking its economic and development links with the majority of the world, in fact, because there's now nearly 160 countries that are participating in China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is an infrastructure development initiative going across all those 160 countries. As I say, we're entering a period of increasing conflict, and one in which Australia will, I think, become embroiled in the very near future, unless the mass of the Australian population is prepared to come out in a strong anti-war movement to say to the government that we do not feel that Australia should be joining in the American effort to contain China or to defeat Iran or anything else.
Do you see the US and its followers as really on the back foot now concerning China?
Not completely. Economically, the United States is on the back foot, and that ultimately is the determining factor in the long run. The Chinese economy, in purchasing power parity terms, is now larger than the United States. China does not have a massive debt, whereas the United States has a $37 trillion debt, which is completely unpayable and which will sink the United States if the United States dollar ceases to be the international currency of exchange. Because it has for so long been the medium of exchange for trade and financial exchanges between countries all around the world, has always created a demand for US dollars. And so that has helped to sustain the value of the dollar, and of course has resulted also in countries investing the dollars that they earn from their trade into the United States in the form of loans to the United States and to the United States national budget and so on through the purchasing of so-called treasury bonds. Those bonds have to be, interest has to be paid on them, and the interest is, the interest on the treasury bonds of the United States, I believe, is now greater than the total amount of their defense Pentagon budget. And the capital that would have to be repaid to those who've bought treasury bonds, as I say, is over $37 million now, $1 trillion. And according to the size of the United States GDP, that debt is actually physically unpayable, particularly if the United States dollar ceases to be treated as a currency of value for most countries. And this is, I think, the main reason why the United States is so determined to try to disrupt China, and particularly to disrupt China's key contribution to the whole development of the multilateral world order through the creation and growth of the BRICS organization in particular. Military parade to celebrate or to commemorate the victory of China against fascism and the Imperial Japanese War against China has been, I think, mischaracterized by Australian mass media, the mainstream media, as a display of China's force and a demonstration of the extent to which China is becoming increasingly aggressive. I watched the whole parade on Chinese television, and it really came across to me more as, particularly with the evening celebrations showing the history of the Japanese invasion of China from 1931 until 1945, China was fighting off Japan. The Second World War didn't last for 4 and a bit years for China. It was more like 15 years of fighting, and they lost 35 million people in the process and were utterly devastated. So when I went to China in 1974, it was one of the poorest countries in the world. It is now probably the richest, or at least the second richest country in the world in terms of its GDP, as I say, in purchasing power parity, which is an absolutely astounding achievement. And the parade really came across to me as China saying to the world, we will never let this happen to us again. We are preparing to defend ourselves and to ensure that China cannot be overrun in the way that it was in the lead up to the Second World War. And the emphasis in Xi Jinping's speech was on peace and on the preservation of peace, on the development of cooperative and collaborative relationships with the rest of the world, of contributing to the prosperity of the rest of the world. It's a frequent theme in Chinese political statements that China is seeking to use its prosperity to increase the prosperity of other countries. And of course, it has done so in the case of Australia. Australia would be nothing like as prosperous as it is if we were not able to benefit from a massive trade with China. And of course, nothing could be more foolish than Australia going to war against China and thereby destroying our trade relationship for no good reason.
Can I take you back to the expulsion of the ambassador and the other members of the embassy? Where does that leave Australia in the world of diplomacy? What would other countries be saying or thinking, watching what Albanese has done and the flimsy, as you say, reasons why he has done it?
I don't know what other countries would be thinking. I can only guess at what they would be thinking. But a lot of them, I think, would be seeing the way in which Australia is prepared to bend the knee to the will of the United States, and that and Australia is willing to essentially flout the norms of diplomatic practice which have been established in international relations for well over 500 years. It is no small thing to expel an ambassador. I mean, the next worst thing would be to simply break off diplomatic relations entirely, which has almost happened. We don't have our embassy staffed in Tehran at the moment. I believe they were all evacuated to a neighbouring country, but the embassy wasn't actually closed down, so we haven't formally broken diplomatic relations with Iran, but that would be the next step. And we're very close to it, I think. So I think most other countries would, outside of the West, would take a pretty jaundiced view of Australia's actions, because it's such a flimsy pretext and is so patently obvious to anybody who understands Iran that it's really simply scapegoating Iran to please the Zionist masters in the United States and in Israel. Because you don't forget there are a lot of Zionists in positions of power in the United States.
The trials of these men who have been charged regarding the cafe and the synagogue, how are they going to arrange those so that they're not going to be embarrassed, the government's not going to be embarrassed further?
Well, again, I don't know.
You could imagine.
I haven't seen anything coming from the government about the trials and whether the trials will take place. But I would assume that they would be in camera behind closed doors for quote-unquote security reasons, so that the proceedings of the trial would not be open to the public and probably not even open to the press, certainly not to any independent media. There may be some specially chosen members of the mainstream media who are the servants of the propaganda machine anyway, who may be able to attend, but I don't think there would be, there won't be an open trial, almost certainly.
Can I finish, John, with your assessment of ASIO's role in all this?
ASIO is the servant of the Five Eyes.
Is that it?
That's all. That's it. I don't think anything more needs to be said. In this particular instance, it's very, very patently obvious that ASIO is the servant of the Five Eyes. And the Five Eyes is basically run by, as I said, MI6 and the United States Intelligence Services, the CIA, et cetera, et cetera. So ASIO has done the bidding of the United States, and Australia, in accordance with the so-called intelligence received from ASIO, has likewise done the bidding of the United States.
And those are your final words?
I think so. I think that's enough to be getting on with. I think people need to think about that very carefully and look very critically at what the government is doing in terms of its cooperation with the United States international supremacy objectives.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Jan.
I've been speaking to John Lander, former ambassador to Iran from 1985 to 1987, and deputy ambassador to Beijing from 1974 to 1976.
Public Forum. Cancel AUKUS, no war. Sunday the 21st of September at 2:30pm at the Victorian Trades Hall. AUKUS threatens our security, peace and independence. It is turning Australia into a major US military base and launching pad for US-led war in the region. The Australian government is spending more than $368 billion over the next 30 years on AUKUS submarines. Instead of funding social services, climate action and sovereign manufacturing industries and long-term jobs, what alternatives are there in a global climate of big powers, military build-up and growing tensions? Come to the forum. Cancel AUKUS, no war. 21st September, 2:30pm at Victorian Trades Hall to hear more about AUKUS and how we can organise to stop it. The event will also be live streamed via the Facebook page No AUKUS Coalition Victoria, a 3CR supporter.
RCR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the white Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03-9419-8377.
A Sydney-based event was held recently with the title Exposing the Scam Summit to Combat Anti-Israelism. In the lead-up to the summit, organised by the American organisation CAM, Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, and the Australian Lobby in Australia, which was held on the Gold Coast last weekend. The in-person event featured a panel discussion with subject matter experts on the topic, including journalists Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon, former Greens candidate Hannah Thomas, and criminal lawyer and the host of the What and the Why podcast, Nick Hanna, looking at who are the main stakeholders of the upcoming Combat Semitism Movement Summit, what is the involvement of the Israeli government and the Israeli lobby involvement in this initiative, what is the main purpose of this summit, and why is this summit targeting Australian local councils? Who were the local councillors invited to the summit? Who accepted this invitation? And how do we expose and mobilise to resist their efforts? The first question from Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabadla was, how was this summit featured in the mainstream media?
Well, that's a big question. I think we could say a lot about the complicity of the Australian media in the genocide. Of course, we have one very big part of the Australian media, and whether any of us look at it or not, it is there, and that is News Corporation, that are part of the Zionist team, and they are constantly prosecuting that case. It is easy to sort of dismiss them as a right-wing fringe, which in a sense they are, but you have to remind yourself that they do own every mainstream publication on the Queensland coast and the Courier Mail, and the only mainstream publication in Adelaide, and big ones in Sydney and Melbourne as well. So I'm not going to say any more about News Corp. If we look at the other media, I mean, we could say a lot about the ABC too, and generally there has been enormous pressure within the ABC. And I know some journalists in there who really wrestle with whether they should leave or stay or keep trying within it. But look, every media organisation, I have been in a very wide range of media organisations. If you are a progressive person, you're always sort of in conflict, trying to do the best that you can to get maybe a different perspective out there. So none of that is really new. So today I had a bit of a look, just going now to the summit, at the coverage of the summit. Well, now, first of all, they're really, if the independent and alternative and progressive media did not exist, let's just imagine that for a minute, there wouldn't have been any coverage. We would have been in part of what is now a very conventional media process, where the first thing that happens is a sort of a soft announcement release. And the first article about the summit appeared in the Israeli press back in January, sort of just laying the groundwork. The next thing really that happened, and I think was meant to happen, I mean, the Australian Jewish press published a PR article quoting the CEO in Tel Aviv, Reutman, that he published a sort of soft article quoting himself and calling, interestingly enough, on Clover Moore to be there, because Clover Moore did not go to a summit sort of organised by Darcy Byrne in February, a meeting, and so they really wanted Clover to be there. She is not going to be there. Now, the next thing that I think was meant to happen, and I think it was all part of a plan, was the release of Gillian Siegel's action plan in, I think that was early July. And that was sort of meant to lead up to the summit, when there would be a series of short news items quoting different speakers, and it all would have been very smooth, and then we probably would have moved back on to implementing Gillian Siegel's plan. Now, that is not what has happened. When you think about why hasn't that happened, and I think the fact we're here is that, in fact, Gillian Siegel's action plan alarmed people. I mean, it alarmed all of us, but it alarmed other people who perhaps we might not have expected so much. Like Richard Flanagan, well-known Australian writer, wrote a very powerful opinion piece that was published by Fairfax. And I think really the planning was to implement it smoothly as being disrupted. There's enormous, I mean, this is where everything interacts with everything else. The protest marches put enormous pressure on the government. Everybody doing what they've done out in the streets is all part of it. So Siegel's plan didn't go according to what they wanted. And then we started digging in. Now, Nick actually was already researching when Yakov and I were researching, and we didn't actually know that. But it's worked out, I think, fairly well. Now, one thing I do want to say is you do have to do the research work. You can't just write an opinion piece saying, I don't like this summer. So really, it actually has been an interesting effort. And I think it raises a question that we should all be thinking about, is how to build an alternative media. We've done 5 articles, and now there's one of the things about journalism is you can't put everything in there. Then Nick did his podcast. Now Green Left has also republished, or in a different edited form, everything we've done. And that again reaches a different audience. We've got to sort of see things as audiences. And then the ASU for Palestine down in Melbourne are running a campaign, because of course if Gillian Siegel's plan is implemented, it's the workers who will bear the brunt. So they're doing a really good campaign. Eventually, the Herald and forget the rest, but the Guardian did one article. And that was good because it sort of did highlight the conflict that was building up around it. That was really helpful. I found one thing extraordinary about that article, because they didn't actually mention an actual name associated with this international organisation. I only can assume it's pressure or no time to do the work. But I mean, honestly, it would take you 5 minutes to verify who's head of the organisation. I noticed today, for example, Paul Gregoire, who does criminal lawyers blog, he did an excellent piece on the Christian aspects of all of this, the far-right Christians. So I guess what I'd like to say is that I think we can forget in this case the mainstream. We've probably made it more difficult for them to just do the PR pieces. I think this is really worth looking at as a broader, more collective effort to counter the mainstream. But then in the midst of all of that is that journalism is about the relationship between journalists and their sources, basically summed up as that. And if there wasn't the letter writing, and if there wasn't the Jewish Council of Australia putting out their statements, and all the work that a lot of people here have done, you can't really move forward with the story. That's how journalism works. So I think I should leave it there. But so what was meant to be a lovely PR game has turned into a contest.
With all things political, you need to distinguish between what the stated objective is and what the real objective is. And here the stated objective is of course, to fight anti-Semitism, which, according to CAM and according to the lobby, is the number one crisis that Australia is facing. The reality is, though, that when you look at who the organiser of this summit is, who the leaders of that organisation are, and what their stated goals are, I think it is not difficult at all to divine that the real intention is to advance the interests of Israel, and specifically to stifle criticism of Israel and its current genocide in Gaza through pushing the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, which I think we'll come to a bit later, and also to push support for anti-BDS measures at a council level. And why do I say that? Well, the host of the organizers of the summit is CAM, Combat Anti-Semitism Movement. You look at its leadership, you refer to it as a US organization. I mean, the funding comes from the US, but it is very much an Israeli operation, in the same way that the funding for Israel might come from the US, but they're doing things on their own. They are driving the agenda here. You look at the CEO, who's been the CEO since the outset of CAM, and that's Sasha Roitman. He's former IDF, very senior in the spokesman's unit. He headed the new media unit and was in charge of comms. You've got, I won't go through all of them, you can watch the video to see the full list, but you basically have the who's who of IDF intelligence, comms and censorship, as well as a large number of senior lobby officials and people who are who've been in Israel's national institutions, which I think Yaakov is much more learned about. He can speak to it. That's who the organisation is, but you don't even need to infer their intention from these personnel. You can look at their actual admissions as to what their intention is. If you look at the interviews with Sasha Roitman, the CEO, from when CAM was founded, he was specifically stating, our objective is to push IRA to be adopted by as many organisations and governments as possible. It's all out in the open. Then you have the member of the advisory board of CAM, Seema Vaknin Gil, who is the ex-Israel's chief military censor, and she was the director of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which was responsible for fighting BDS. She gave evidence at a Knesset hearing last year, which has only been the subject of one Guardian. I mean, this is such a huge scandal, just to go back to the point of how the mainstream media really misses the story or deliberately ignores the story. She gave evidence at the Knesset last year, which was it was an inquiry into how can Israel deal with the deluge of criticism and opposition that is inevitably flowing as a result of its genocidal rampage that it's carrying out in Gaza. Well, the evidence that she gave was, we need to push IRA. That's what we're doing at CAM, but we've found that working at the local government level is easier than working with higher levels of government. So again, there you have it. It's very much out in the open. It's a clear expression of an intention to deliberately target Australian mayors and councillors because they are perceived as being more malleable to the lobby, easily capable of being influenced. And that's precisely what they're going to do at the Gold Coast next week.
The Inner West area itself is obviously one of the most progressive areas in the country, even if the council might not be at times. He's clearly so out of touch with our values, as is Zan Maxwell, who's from the city of Sydney and attending as well. The Inner West was home to one of the longest running Palestine protests in terms of the picket outside Albanese's office, another Labour member who's deeply out of touch with his community when it comes to this issue. Darcy knows he's out of touch as well. He wasn't promoting his attendance on any social media that I could see, and I think he's now a bit on the defensive that it's come out, but he's dug his heels in as well and tried to defend his attendance. But I would say he has form, Darcy, in terms of conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. When there was a BDS motion brought to the Inner West Council by the Greens last year, he shamefully labelled protesters there as anti-Semitic. So this is something that he has form in. Since then, obviously, the tide has turned massively, and he knows that it's not quite so easy to get away with that. So one of his excuses for going is that he claims that he's going to raise objections in his speech. He's not just going, he's speaking there to the fact that CAM has called people who went to the march on the Harbour Bridge anti-Semitic. He says in his address he's going to criticise the Netanyahu government. I think it's really important to note that there is no attendance at this summit that is in any way defensible, except if you're outside as a protester. It doesn't matter if you're raising specific objections to stuff that the organizers have said, this summit is completely beyond redemption. It is doing nothing other than trying to stifle criticism of Israel to make it easier for them to keep getting away with their genocide. So there is no way to attend this summit that is in any way defensible and that is in any way in accordance with the values of the Inner West, which, you know, as someone who has campaigned on Palestine in this area pretty recently, I can say that the reception we got was overwhelmingly supportive of Palestine and against Israel's actions. And I think since we were campaigning, that has increased by tenfold.
The IHRA definition is very concerning. It's the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition, they call it. Now, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, was literally founded to create this definition and hasn't done anything else beyond that. And it hasn't done anything since. It was created to aggregate data and do research of what anti-Semitism is, and it had to first start with a definition. So people would make reports and they would be like, well, we don't really know if it's anti-Semitic or not, so we're going to use this definition as a guideline so we can understand if this thing is worth reporting through a portal, through putting it into a spreadsheet, putting it into authorities. It was never meant for local governments. It was never meant for police. It was never meant for laws. It was never meant for parliaments or workplaces. Now, its lead drafter, Kenneth Stern, has specifically criticized it for this. He said it's used in an Orwellian way, those are his words, to crack down on political dissent, specifically criticism of Israel and Zionism. Now, Kenneth Stern to this day is a Zionist, and even he recognizes it was a definition that continues to be called a working definition, as in it is not perfected, even by its own admission. And now we're trying to get it implemented in local governments by the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement at this summit. I mean, they're looking to create grading systems of all councils across Australia based on their implementation of the IRA definition. You know, I'll give you an example of why this is so problematic. It gives different examples of what is anti-Semitic. One of those is denying the Jewish people their right to their national self-determination in their ancestral homeland of Israel. Those are my words, those are theirs. So in other words, if you think that there should be a one-state solution in Palestine, well, what do you know? The majority of the people who live between the river and the sea are actually not Jewish. The majority of them are Palestinian. If you then take into account the right of return for refugees, people of Palestinian descent like Ahmed, we're talking about 2-to-1 ratio, Jews, the non-Jews to Jews. So it's not going to be a Jewish state anymore because every person's going to have an equal vote. And they're not going to vote for Likud, for Bibi Netanyahu. So in other words, according to IRA definition, you are now anti-Semitic because you were calling for the destruction, they would say, of the Jewish state. You're denying the Jewish people their right to national self-determination, because if every person between the river and the sea gets one vote, there's not going to be an Israel. That's why it relies on apartheid. If you say that Israel specifically targeting children in the West Bank, well, then there is room within that definition, that very flawed definition, to say that this is the apparently ancient anti-Semitic trope of blood libel. Blood libel is a real anti-Semitic trope. It's just being misused and exploited here. I mean, in the medieval ages, there were myths being spread, rumors spread that, you know, Jews were, you know, kidnapping Christian babies and doing child sacrifice in their basement. The truth is, unfortunately, that Israel is embodying the worst that humanity has to offer. It is targeting children. It's snipers are shooting them in the head. How do you deal with that? The IRA definition cannot be implemented by councils. It cannot be implemented by police as a guideline for investigating someone at a protest is saying that there should be a one-state solution. It's ludicrous, and this is why it's so dangerous, and it is exactly why the Israeli government is pushing for it to be spread all across the world. How do we speak about, you know, the genocide in Gaza without being labelled as anti-Semite, as this summit is trying to do?
First of all, I don't think they are going to stop talking about in the way they do and labelling people. I mean, when I went on this week onto the CAM website and actually saw that on Sunday, that is just as we're wrapping up our protest, 300,000 people around Australia, Reutman, he's the CEO in Tel Aviv, was writing in the Jerusalem Post that people were stigmatising and delegitimising his conference in Australia. Now, he didn't name any particular individuals, but, you know, they were so on the job. By the next day, there were two articles up on the CAB website. And again, you sort of wonder, you know, don't journalists look at these things? I guess because it's not a topic in their head, they don't, but it's not hard to find. But basically what they're saying is that the Iranian guards have funded all the protests. That's what he now thinks. So this is just completely ludicrous, but nevertheless to put out there. And also, but then it is actually really sinister, because then the intelligence agencies and the security agencies of the world have to be unleashed on us, on all the people around the world, most of whom are a lot more vulnerable than I am, could be subject to surveillance and suppression. And we can see in London, lots of people are actually getting arrested because they are not people. And I watched a bit of video of the Waverley Council. They have actually adopted, since Wilna Meesh became mayor and invited the Advance Australia Robert Gregory onto the Multicultural Committee, they have actually implemented the IHRA definition. The two Greens on council, one person, Dominic Wykenak, the long-term Greens councillor, he dared to speak of what he argued is he was very moderate. He said he would accept the Jerusalem definition, which is a broader idea. So he was a sole voice. It was a very intimidating atmosphere. He was actually on Zoom. And after he spoke, they unleashed on him. And they said it was unfathomable that anyone could even have that thought. So they absolutely condemned him, said that things would have to be done about this. And Dominique is out there over in the eastern suburbs trying to stand up for what he believes in. And he's getting badly bullied. Now, he's a strong person who took a boat through, saw down a Botany one day with a Palestinian flag, so I'm sure he won't be silenced. But and then Susie Gold, who's here today, she and Judith Treylor from the Jews Against the Occupation 48 just stood up at a Willoughby Council meeting in the public gallery, read out a short condemnation speech and calling on the councillors, one of them is going, not to attend. And the mayor, as Susie, as they got up, sort of said, well, I hope you're, going to be respectful and keep everyone so everyone can feel safe. Now, that is the sort of line, you know, let everyone feel safe. No one was remotely unsafe. And then I think one day she told Susie, look, you've got to look at me, the mayor. You're not allowed to look at councillors. Well, that's a new thing. But en masse, we don't shut up. But people are put down, suppressed, in little ways as well as big ways. When you have a big Antoinette case, Latouf case, when she got sacked, everyone learned an enormous amount. That has been a really big deal, and she won out. But it's more like the little bullying acts that really worry me. If I could just say one more thing about it, I guess the night that I really understood what weaponizing, this goes to something Hannah was saying, was the night we were at the Inner West Council meeting, which Hannah mentioned with the BDS motion. I was actually there in relation to another issue. And I watched everything that was happening very carefully, very carefully. I then listened to the whole webcast later to double check that I didn't miss anything. Then I wrote an account of it later. But the next day when I saw that Darcy Byrne, it was by then in News Corporation that the citizens of the Inner West who were at that meeting had yelled at people because they had Jewish names. I actually felt quite scared. I mean, that you can create a narrative like that, vilify people, and a lot of them, you know, the ones I later quoted in stories were from Palestinian backgrounds. I mean, what, or Arabic backgrounds also, what that actually must feel like, you know, that you're there trying to make your point, and next thing you're labelled as anti-Semitic. I think it's disgraceful. But what I also realise is this power to create the narrative. People are left saying, sorry, we don't agree with that. We don't think it happened. And I know the Greens councillors did stand up later.
Lobbyists and pro-Israel activists who are speaking at this summit. You also have the sponsors, which Wendy and Yaakov have done some excellent articles about, and they can speak to in more detail about. But essentially, these are also Israel lobby groups that I think make it clear that this summit has very little to do with fighting anti-Semitism, but a whole lot to do with fighting criticism of Israel. Gillian Siegel's plan to combat anti-Semitism, which is truly terrifying, sets out a series of proposed radical reforms for Australia in just about every major sphere of public life, including criminal law. And in relation to criminal law, which is one of the aspects of the plan that I focused on due to the fact that I'm a criminal lawyer, she proposes anti-Semitic education and training for judicial officers and police officers and prosecutors. In terms of what that training entails, she doesn't say it, but if you look to the types of training and education that's been provided in other countries and other jurisdictions where they have adopted IRA in the criminal justice system, you see that what effectively it means is when the police are deciding whether to charge people for hate crimes or similar offences, they use the IRA definition. What does the IRA definition entail? Well, Yaakov gave a few examples. Another very important one is that it is considered to be anti-Semitic to allege that the state of Israel is a racist endeavour. So if you call Israel an apartheid state, which we should bear in mind every single major human rights organization in the world, including Israeli human rights organizations, allege, then you are being anti-Semitic, then you are potentially committing a criminal offence. And that is exactly what the lobby wants to see happen here. I can reveal, it's not yet public, but it will be very soon, I've had a client issued with a criminal infringement notice in the past couple of weeks for saying, fuck Israel, that's one charge, and then another charge, death, death to the IDF. So we are now seeing the police take action, take criminal action against people for expressing opposition, admittedly robust opposition, to the state of Israel. This is just a very minor example of a much more serious phenomenon that I think we will observe if the lobby gets its way. And if we continue down the current trajectory, not only will they silence people by threatening to have them dismissed, by encouraging people to phone up their businesses or leave bad Google reviews, all this sort of activity that we've seen over the past couple of years, complaining to professional bodies, so that doctors, nurses, lawyers who speak up for Palestinian human rights are facing disciplinary proceedings, but we will see criminal prosecution. We will see people facing the possibility of imprisonment for making legitimate criticisms of an apartheid genocidal regime. That is where we're heading if we don't take immediate action to stop it. The police are being asked to protect the interests of a foreign power more than the citizens of this country, right? That's the madness that we're living in.
I'd just like to add one thing to that. And in a way, it's not about, I guess, fighting back. To me, in the inner West, and also actually it's a national thing as well, this whole issue has to be put in the context of the longer term. And what we saw last year was what we call the astroturfing political campaigns. For me, that's partly where this story began, because after the meeting at the Inner West Council that defeated the BDS, then very shortly after that, they launched this Better Council organisation that was bipartisan. It was Sophie Calland in the ALP, and it was a guy, particularly a guy called Alex Paulson, who used to work for retired Liberal Senator Simon Birmingham, but is a sort of businessman floating around in the Middle East with a small consultancy firm that I can't find out what exactly it does. But anyway, he's active in Australia. This Better Council, which in the federal election became Better Australia, campaigned very heavily against the Greens. Now, in terms of the inner West, what this meant was that they went out on all the pre-polls and the polling booths on election day and said that the Greens didn't care about rubbish and rates, but only cared about supporting terrorists or only cared about international issues, and basically put false propaganda out there. That's why it's called astroturfing. Now, it's very relevant to what's happening in the inner West now, why, you know, we just have to keep on their backs. But if you look at the actual results in the election, with this thing, put the Greens last, which was their message, that really affected preferences, not so much the primary vote. So say in the Stanmore ward, where Liz Atkins is here today, there was a good chance she will get two, not one, Greens councillors. In practice, we got, I think, a Liberal, a Labor. Did we get a Liberal, a Labor, and a Green, or two Labor? Two Labor and a Green. Two Labor and a Green. Now, that turns on not many preferences at all. You don't have to do that much. So I'll move on from that, because that effectively gave the sort of meant control of council was even more in the hands of Darcy and the Labor councillors. Now, what in practice that means is that it doesn't matter what is put up there, even if it's just a moderate, minor amendment, means maybe not much, it'll get slammed down. It's an exercise in power. And if you watch those meetings, you can see that. Now, I'll just jump to now. Who turns up as a senior advisor for the combat anti-Semitism movement in the States? There are only five of them, and one is a specialist in stopping BDSs. Another is Alex Paulson. So he is full-time at the moment organising the conference in the Gold Coast. He is the one who is making the calls, talking over with people what they're going to say. Now, it's very hard to get all the evidence on that, but so we have some, what I guess I'm trying to say is you have to look at the people behind and see how they are connected, which is what we've done with the Zionist lobby and what Nick and Yakov know a lot more about than I do. But you've got to look behind and see how the movement, how their movement is sort of transforming and exercising power in different ways. So I just wanted to say, they're still on about the astroturfing. It's still, there's another thing called the Minority Impact Coalition, which is actually connected with Advance Australia. They're still doing the stuff. They'll be doing it right now up in Queensland in various ways, just putting the propaganda out there. And when there's another election campaign, they'll be on the case. So we have to keep our eye on what they're doing.
The great irony of what Wendy's been saying is this guy, Alex Paulson, job just before this was being a full-time organiser of an astroturfing campaign to make councils return to, the slogan was, return to roads, rates and rubbish, and stop trying to pretend to be the UN. That was the other slogan. Stop getting involved in geopolitics. Now he's part of an international organisation funded by billionaires, taking its memos and talking points from Tel Aviv to protect the genocidal state of Israel and interfere with local government. Does he actually want us to return to roads, rates and rubbish? I'm just really confused. I mean, even last year when he was running this Better Council astroturfing group, it was that they would only actually target councils when there was a motion that had something to do with supporting Palestine. There were lots of councils, specifically ones, the one that he lived in, Waverley Council, had the Israel flag flying up since October 7 for several months. But he didn't want that one to return to roads, rates and rubbish and stop pretending to be the UN. No, he wanted the council next door, Randwick Council, when they were voting on a motion that actually had a serious chance of being in support of Palestine and getting up. That was when he mobilized his astroturfing resources. So I want you to imagine here this bizarre analogy, because Israel is absolutely running this show, the Israeli state. Now they're trying to push their own definition of anti-Semitism with their own organizations, ran by their own ministries, ran by their own national institutions. So imagine this analogy, right? Imagine Gina Reinhart makes an application to have several mines in different countries across Africa. They all get knocked back. She says, this is because of sexism. And she becomes a very staunch feminist. And she starts up an organization, Combat Sexism Movement. And they have the International Anti-Sexism Remembrance Alliance definition of sexism that they push everywhere. It says that one example of sexism is denying Gina Reinhart her right to have a gold mine in Rwanda. There's a parliamentary inquiry funded by Gina Reinhart and her organizations where she says, you know, I was really victimized by this sexism. There's a parliamentary inquiry into sexism. And Gina Reinhart's the star witness. And all of her cronies, the secondary witnesses. That is literally what's happening here with Israel. We shouldn't mince our words here. This is a bizarre, ludicrous, absurd, surreal operation of foreign interference ran by a genocidal state that is exploiting and abusing and twisting the meaning of what it is to be anti-Semitic to cover its ass.
I haven't looked into laws involving foreign agents, and especially in the context of criminal prosecution, so I'm not going to pretend to answer. So I'll take that question on notice.
The Green spokesperson for local government, Amanda Cohn, raised this with me, and we'd already seen it at a political level. I mean, of course, it is foreign interference. Does it fit into a specific law is the question. So I ended up looking up the Foreign Interference Transparency Register, which is a piece of legislation where if you're lobbying to get policy changed and you're an overseas agent, you have to register. didn't notice many Israelis on the register generally, which was a bit of a worry. And to me, when I tried to grapple with this law, it seemed to get down to, was it only for Commonwealth activities and would this apply? But I really think someone should have a good look at this and see if it can meet the legal requirements. It doesn't necessarily mean, I don't know what the penalties are for not going on the register. So look, I just also want to add one more point to what I said before. I wanted to say this isn't just speculation that I'm making about better councils and Alex Paulson and the Inner West Council. This is something that's been admitted by Alex Paulson. He was in a meeting of Better Council, and we've seen the Zoom, Yaakov and myself have seen the Zoom of this meeting, and he was asked by a person over in the eastern suburbs, why aren't we targeting Labor in the inner west? Like, we are targeting Labor over in the east. And his explanation was, well, Darcy Byrd has done us a good thing with stopping the BDS in the inner west. So we're sort of rewarding him. So it's all on the record. There's no secret about it.
And you've been listening to part one of a longer webinar from the Sydney-based event Exposing the Scam Summit to Combat, in quote, anti-Israelism, unquote. It was organised to talk about the then upcoming summit organised by the American organisation CAM, Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, and the Israeli Lobby in Australia, and that was held on the Gold Coast recently. The panel members you've been hearing from were Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon, former Greens candidate Hannah Thomas, and criminal lawyer and host of the What and the Why podcast, Nick Hannah. Some of the questions they were looking at were, who are the main stakeholders of the upcoming Combat Anti-Semitism Movement Summit? What is the involvement of the Israeli government and the Israeli lobby involved in this initiative? What is the main purpose of this summit? Who is this summit targeting? Why is this summit targeting Australia's local councils? Who are the local councils invited to the summit? Who accepted this invitation, and how do we expose and mobilise to resist these efforts? And just to remind you of this summit organised by the American Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, their blurb is as follows. From the 3rd to the 5th of September on the Gold Coast in Queensland, it will be chaired by Tom Tate, Mayor of the City of the Gold Coast. The summit committee includes four esteemed CAM advisory board members: David Gonski, AC, co-chair; Stanley Ross, AM, co-chair; Dr. Orna Trigomoff and Dr. Ron Weiser, AM. And it goes on. Stand up locally, unite nationally, join the local government summit against anti-Semitism. The 2025 Mayor's Summit Against Anti-Semitism, hosted by the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, CAM, and chaired by Gold Coast Mayor Tom Tate, will bring together more than 250 local government leaders and community advocates from across Australia in a collective effort to secure and nurture common understanding and safety in our communities. Local government is uniquely positioned on the front line of communities to proactively confront hate, which is most acutely felt, and local leadership in this issue sets a powerful example that can be emulated both at home and abroad. As anti-Semitism rises globally, an international community is responding. From the United States to Germany, Greece and Latin America, now it's Australia's turn to join this growing movement of local leadership. You'll be joined by fellow local government leaders, members of parliament, community and religious leaders from all denominations, including the 2024 conference host from the United States, Beverly Hills Mayor Sharona Nazarine. Acts of hate are on the rise in Australia, and as community leaders, we must commit to a safe and peaceful future. Your voice is crucial in showing that hate has no place in our society. And that's the propaganda that is floating around Australia, pushing anti-Semitism.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're ready to make a difference? My name is Nasser Mashni. I host Palestine Remembered each Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. It's Australia's only dedicated radio show on Palestine. 3CR Community Radio is more than just a station. It's a platform for voices you won't hear anywhere else. And we need you. 3CR is an outlet that gives a voice to the voiceless. For nearly five decades, 3CR has amplified the struggles, stories, and successes of marginalised and silenced communities. From First Nation voices to workers' rights and grassroots campaigns to global solidarity, this is where justice speaks. When you subscribe to 3CR, you're not just tuning in, you're taking a stand. You're supporting independent media that fights for truth, diversity, and equality. 3CR is powered by people like you. No ads, no corporate control, just raw, real radio created by the community for the community. So what are you waiting for? Show your solidarity today. Subscribe to 3CR and help us keep the airways free for voices that matter.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnina. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajara on Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
One of the least known countries in Central America is Costa Rica. Borders Nicaragua to the north, the Caribbean Sea to the northeast, Panama to the southeast, and the Pacific Ocean to the southwest. A country which is known globally as one of the most biodiverse countries in the world, hosting nearly 6% of the planet's known species, despite covering only 0.03% of its landmass. And a country whose government junta abolished the military altogether. So today on Tuesday Home Time, we're going to remedy all that with Dr. Sasha Gillies-Lukakis. And as usual, Sasha, when you're discussing a Latin American country, we learn about the indigenous peoples of the area.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. Today we're looking at Costa Rica, which means rich coast, wealthy coast. That's what the Spanish named it when they first arrived, which is interesting considering that for a very long time, the Spanish didn't actually appreciate what Costa Rica had to offer. And in fact, when they called it rich coast, they were speaking about the incredible natural beauty and the natural diversity of the area. They weren't actually talking about the resources this time. As you said, it's environmentally a very, very miraculous country. It's one of the most biodiverse countries on the planet. Thousands and thousands of species, many of them endemic to Costa Rica and the jungles that are in and around Costa Rica and neighboring countries. And as a result, it's one of the most popular tourism destinations in Central America. You can see jaguars, tapirs, all sorts of exotic birds, fish, caiman, you know, the small alligator that South America and Central America have. So, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful country. And it has a reputation as being a very stable country by comparison to its neighbors, a safe country. Now, that sort of has, I guess, obscured some of the darker sides to this country, which we'll get into. It's recently been the site of violent crime, which has been on the rise quite dramatically in recent years. And according to the Gini coefficient index, it's the most unequal country in Latin America, which might surprise people. But of course, to understand how Costa Rica has got to that point, we go back to the indigenous people, the pre-Columbian people of Costa Rica, and they were chiefly hunters and gatherers. So no major civilizations like the Aztecs or the Incas or the Maya. But very interestingly, we had a convergence of two different types of cultures in Costa Rica because of its location right at the bottom of Central America near Panama. And we actually saw a mixture of Mesoamerican cultures, so Aztec and Mayan type peoples who had gone up through the Andean Mountains, through Colombia and Panama into Costa Rica. And this is one of the few places where they actually met and intermingled. So the more Mesoamerican influenced culture was called the Nicoya culture, which was centered on the Pacific coast of Costa Rica. Of course, Costa Rica has a Pacific coast and a Caribbean coast, while the southern parts of the country belonged to the Muisca people. So these were the more Andean influenced people who come up from South America. So, you know, very, very unique fusion, even by the standards of other indigenous parts of Latin America. But by and large, hunters and gatherers, so no major settlements to speak of. Most of these people were nomadic, and they would just go around to the different parts of Costa Rica, to the different parts of the rainforest or the coastline, as the seasons demanded, basically. Whenever there was scarcity in the jungle or when that became too difficult to inhabit, they would move to the coastline. And similarly, when the coastline, you know, got too difficult to live in chiefly because of natural disasters and very unpredictable weather during the cyclone season or the hurricane season over there, they would move back into the interior. And they generally lived quite peacefully. These people, the Muisca and the Nicoya, were not particularly violent, or they didn't have that sort of warrior tradition, which, you know, was quite a challenge for them when the Spanish did indeed arrive. And the Spanish first arrived in 1503. This was Christopher Columbus himself. They arrived at Isla Uvita, which is an island on the Caribbean side of Costa Rica's coastline. And they very quickly overcame the indigenous people. In fact, really, you know, by the mid-1500s, the population had decreased from what people estimate to be 120,000 indigenous people down to about 10,000 people in 50 years. So, you know, this is a frighteningly quick drop, collapse in the population. And that, of course, was a mixture of violence, Spanish, of course, massacring different tribes and villages, and of course the usual suspect of measles and smallpox, which decimated anyone that was left. So as I said, yeah, by the mid-1500s, we had about 10,000 indigenous people left, where once there had been about 120,000. Now, the interesting thing about Costa Rica, as I mentioned, it's called Costa Rica in Spanish, means wealthy coast or rich coast. They were not talking about resources. They were talking about the stunning natural beauty, the rainforests, the coastline, the animals and the plant life. But resource-wise, Costa Rica was virtually devoid of resources. And to this day, it's pretty much devoid of resources. The Spanish did eventually set up coffee plantations, cocoa plantations, a little bit of livestock rearing. But by and large, it was a very, very poor and isolated part of the Spanish Empire. It was far away from Mexico. Of course, today you can fly from Costa Rica to Mexico in a few hours. But back then, particularly traversing through rainforest, it took an incredibly long time to get from the center of power in Mexico City and from the other center of power. Forget it. people just wouldn't travel there up to Costa Rica. It was far too difficult. So Costa Rica sort of sat and festered by itself, and it was even described by a Spanish governor in the 1800s as the poorest and most miserable Spanish colony in all America. So this is what the Spanish governor there used in terms of his language to describe Costa Rica. So the coffee plantations were generally not very productive or profitable. Again, most of Costa Rica is dense rainforest, which does not suit well to coffee plantations. And it was just too dense for the Spanish to clear in any sort of large way. Cocoa production, very, very limited. Cattle rearing, again, very, very limited. And, you know, it was so poor that even the Spanish governor had to tend to his own crops, generally speaking. So this was how poor and isolated Costa Rica was. Slavery, yes, was a part of the economy. They did bring in some slaves from Africa to grow the coffee and to grow the cocoa. But again, this was a very, very small percentage of the population. Today, Afro-Costa Ricans are about 5% of the population, which is very small by comparison to other parts, even of Central America. And the indigenous people today are about 2%. So very, very small percentage. And that is chiefly mixed blood people. That is, you know, a mixture of European and indigenous, or African and indigenous. In terms of a, you know, a sustained indigenous culture like there is in Mexico or Peru or Colombia, that doesn't really exist anymore in Costa Rica. So there wasn't a labor force to make this colony productive. They just couldn't even afford to get slaves in, a lot of the so-called landlords that were in Costa Rica. So what we saw, and, you know, this is pretty much the exception, the only exception to the rule in Latin America, where in other countries you had these slave-based societies, plantation economies. In Costa Rica, you actually had what was more like a European-style feudal system, because they had to basically force migrants from Spain to come over to Costa Rica to work this land. A bit later in the 1800s, they had to bring Chinese and Indian immigrants over. They even enticed British profiteers in Jamaica and the English Caribbean to ship some Jamaicans over because they couldn't even afford slaves from Spanish merchants. So very, very unique sort of colony. And as I mentioned, the governors of this area of Costa Rica had to tend to their own land. That was unheard of in the other parts of Latin America. So it was a very, very different type of society. In fact, you know, most Spanish merchants and Spanish nobles, they generally considered Costa Rica to be a failed colony, because it wasn't a colonial society in the traditional sense. It was really like Spain. It was a feudal system, a feudal European type economy, where most people, and to this day, 70% of Costa Ricans are European descendant. So, you know, they are white Costa Ricans and they are white Latin American people, because that was the only type of person that they could force to come over, and that they knew they wouldn't have to pay for, because there was a system of bondage where European lords, or I should say like the peninsula-based Spaniards, could force their workers and could force people over to Latin America, to Costa Rica and other parts. And those lords in Costa Rica, those conquistadors and those nobles, did not have to pay. There was a bit of an agreement, an understanding that was reached between different families, because those people in Costa Rica could not afford to buy slaves. And as we mentioned, all the indigenous people were virtually eradicated. So, you know, a very, very sort of stagnant economy. As they said, the most miserable colony in Latin America. No one wanted to go there. You only went there if you were forced to. Now, when independence did come around, this, of course, came in 1821. This was when the entirety of Central America rose up and fought against the Spaniards. This also happened in Costa Rica because, of course, in the capital, San Jose, or it would become the capital, there was a nascent liberal movement. There were small liberal circles that did want to free themselves from Spanish rule, and that thought that they could improve the prosperity of Costa Rica by aligning themselves with the other Central American countries, either as an independent country, as Costa Rica, or as part of some sort of confederation, as an equal member with the other Central American countries. Now, what ended up happening was, initially, when they declared independence in 1821, and these liberal groups were victorious against the Spaniards, they were absorbed into the Mexican Empire, which was not what the Liberals had planned. They had wanted either, as I said, independence or joining a federation of Central American states, you know, of the smaller Central American countries where they could have a greater say. Now, ultimately, this did happen because all of the Central American countries separated from the Mexican Empire in 1823, some of them in very bloody wars with Mexico. Costa Rica avoided that by and large. Again, it was a very, very part of Central America. It wasn't really a prize in Mexico's eyes. So it was sort of just let go, cut loose when the rest of the Central American provinces also separated. And in 1823, they then coalesced into the United Provinces of Central America, which, as we've discussed in, you know, our previous interviews with about Honduras, was this attempt to build a sort of egalitarian, socially oriented Central American republic. And, you know, for a time they were successful. They did implement some very progressive reforms. The Liberals that were in charge, they universalized access to public education at the primary school level. They significantly reduced the influence of the Catholic Church, and some, for some brief periods, were able to actually abolish the power of the Catholic Church in education and in healthcare and in politics. But ultimately, there were vested interests in these different Central American provinces, including, sadly, in Costa Rica. Costa Rica was actually one of the most strident critics of these more radical liberals that were chiefly from El Salvador and Nicaragua. And them, alongside Guatemala, they essentially led a secession. They were the leaders of the attempt to secede from the United Provinces of Central America. But again, the Costa Ricans were not really involved in the fighting. That was more Guatemala against El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras. But certainly politically, this liberal, well, they were initially a liberal elite, but they very quickly sort of joined the conservative camp that Guatemala was being ruled by. And they decided that they were better off separating. And because when we look at the breakup and the composition of the different interests in Costa Rica at this time, yes, there's the small liberal elite in San Jose, but outside of that, it is essentially plantation owners. Even though they're very poor by comparison, these are still the people that pull the strings in Costa Rica. It's the coffee planters and the cocoa planters, the cacao planters. And they are the ones who pushed the Liberals in the direction of secession. And they ultimately agreed. They ultimately agreed and they unified. And by 1838, when we see this breakup and we've seen several different protracted wars among the Central American countries, or there was a battle in Costa Rica in very early on, 1823, the Battle of Ocho Morgo, which was between those who were in favor of remaining a part of the United Provinces and those who sided with Guatemala and wanted to secede. And of course, those were the ones who won out. And by 1838, so a very lengthy and convoluted process, as we discussed in our other interviews, you know, there were periods when some of the country seceded and then were brought back in by force or negotiation. But by 1838, all of the five Central American countries separated, went their own ways, including Costa Rica, which became the Republic of Costa Rica in 1838. Now, this secession did nothing to improve the economy in Costa Rica, to improve the lot of everyday Costa Ricans. They still had no infrastructure. And indeed, under the United Provinces, they were starting to see new roads, in particular leading out to the Pacific and the Caribbean coast, so that there could be a quicker commercial route to export coffee and to export cacao. But these roads were never finished, and a lot of them were destroyed when there were these battles and these attempts to secede on the part of the Costa Rican planters. So there was no infrastructure. Coffee and cacao planters were still not making any sort of money because they were connected to the Central Valley, you know, which is a very, very geographically inaccessible area. Now, eventually, by the 1840s, the mid-1840s, there were some roads leading out only to the Pacific coast. Those Caribbean coastal roads were not finished until much, much later. And what we saw was, again, very interestingly, and it's something that didn't happen in the rest of Latin America, a unity in purpose of the elite in Costa Rica. So there wasn't a liberal conservative divide. As I mentioned, the planters and the liberals in San Jose essentially unified together, and they remained unified throughout this period. So there were no civil wars. There was no really sort of strongman that emerged as we saw in other parts of Central America. Really, we saw what was basically a one-party dictatorship right through up until the 20th century. I'm not going to skip there just yet because there's a few other important events, but just to give you an idea that we had uninterrupted elite rule and they were unified in the policies that they decided to implement throughout the 1800s. So this included strong support for the Catholic Church, so quite regressive social policies, extreme discrimination against Afro-Costa Ricans and Indigenous Costa Ricans. As I mentioned, collectively, they're about 7% of the population, which is nothing. But, you know, these people weren't allowed to travel outside of Costa Rica. There were internal checks. So there was actually an internal apartheid system in Costa Rica where if you were Afro-Costa Rican or if you were Indigenous Costa Rican, you needed special permits to travel to certain parts of the country. Oftentimes, you had to belong to someone or to be in the employ of someone, like a master or a planter, to be able to travel. And, you know, this was quite extreme compared to other parts of Latin America. You often didn't have these official internal checks and, you know, checkpoints and sort of permissions that needed to be granted for these people just to move around. In fact, it's one of the only countries where this became, you know, quite sustained for about really from the 1840s right up until the 1930s, 1940s. So right about a century, this was common practice. And that's why to this day, Afro-Costa Ricans and Indigenous Costa Ricans are heavily discriminated against. And economically speaking, it was a plantation economy, a very small one and a very sort of weak one, but it was nonetheless that type of model where they would export their products chiefly to Mexico, to the United States, and to the Caribbean islands to service the British and the Spanish. So, you know, this was export oriented, very, very little industry to speak of. In fact, even to this day, there's very little industry or industrialization in Costa Rica, because they've consistently relied on this plantation export economy. It's not a profitable one in Costa Rica. As we mentioned, these are very, very small and irregular crops, and there is no way, to this day, there has not been a way to make this an overly profitable industry in Costa Rica. Agriculturalism has not worked in Costa Rica like it has in other Latin American countries where there is more land and where there's better land and better soil. But nonetheless, they pursued this, the elites, they pursued this. And really, they didn't get their money so much from the crops themselves, but rather from lucrative shipping contracts because of Costa Rica's strategic location, sort of near the Isthmus of Panama. So they weren't even really making a lot of money from the crops themselves, but they also had interests and commercial stakes in other ventures. And, you know, oftentimes they would buy into US commercial ventures or British or Spanish commercial ventures from those ventures. So that's the sort of economy we're looking at in Costa Rica. Now, in the 1850s, 1856 to be exact, the Costa Ricans were forced to sort of get out of their complacence and this sort of very, very monotone path that they were following when William Walker, who was the American mercenary, invaded Nicaragua to overthrow a more radical leader, and he was deposed, and the Americans essentially ruled as a dictator virtually in Nicaragua, reintroduced slavery into Nicaragua, and he had designs for the other Central American countries. Now, initially, the Costa Rican government wanted to be on good terms with Walker, with the American occupation. They actually tried to negotiate, you know, more favorable relations with this new regime because they actually were not friends of the former Nicaraguan government, which was more radical. But unfortunately for them, they were forced into war with this American mercenary because he had his eyes on Costa Rica. That was the next step for him after Nicaragua. He wanted to expand his little fiefdom by conquering Costa Rica, and then the hope was eventually Panama and the other Central American countries. So in 1856, he actually launched a war against Costa Rica. And the Costa Ricans, of course, were forced to react. So the commander-in-chief of the Costa Rican army, who was Juan Rafael Porras, was forced to act. He fought against the Americans. And within about a year and a bit, he drove William Walker out of Nicaragua. They actually liberated Nicaragua, and they were able to install a more pliant regime that wanted to have better relations with the more conservative Central American countries, which at this time, of course, was Costa Rica. But it just goes to show that from that, really from as early as the 1850s, we have seen the Costa Rican elite acquiescing. You know, they wanted to acquiesce to the Americans, or in this case, US mercenaries, and they always served as a counter-revolutionary force in Central America. As early back as the 1850s, they would rather align with US mercenaries than with a radical, more independent government in Nicaragua, for example. And really, after this point, again, we just saw what they call peaceful democracy. This is something that is often, that is actually a source of a lot of controversy in Costa Rica today, that they have a reputation as being a peaceful country and a stable country, which is true. But this so-called peaceful democracy has not been peaceful for people in Costa Rica. And I'm not just talking about, as we mentioned, the Afro and Indigenous people there, but there are huge chunks of the Costa Rican population that are of European descent that live in dismal poverty. And during this period, I mentioned Costa Rica is the most unequal country in Latin America, more than Brazil, more than Chile. And that is because you have such a large chunk of the population, about 30 to 40% living in very, very bad conditions, like very, very bad poverty. And they have not been able to reduce this poverty at all. And this started early on when you had this uninterrupted, virtually one-party rule. Of course, there were elections, but none of the parties ever changed anything. It was the same policies throughout for about a century. Again, it was these policies of favoring the planters, of favoring the commercial interests in San Jose, and of essentially making sure that there was no investment in infrastructure, in schools, in healthcare, so that these rich elites could make money. And, you know, they were much cleverer than the conservative liberal splitters in other countries, because they essentially agreed to divide the spoils. They saw through the ideological differences, and they just made a killing for a century. Now, there was a brief period of dictatorship from 1917 to 1919. This was led by a general, Federico Tinoco Granados, who essentially intervened due to one of the rare disputes that there was between the planters and the liberals in San Jose. And he intervened on behalf of the planters to essentially grant more concessions, economic concessions to cattle export, cacao export, and coffee export, which the liberals had tried to remove. That was the source of the controversy. But then after those 2 years, it went back to this, you know, these elections that consist, you know, pro-elite candidates. And this virtually continued unabated right up until the 1940s. And this is very interesting, because in the 1940s, we have the one instance where the Costa Rican people finally turned against this system, this, you know, very, very corrupt democracy, and attempted to overturn it. And we also saw one of the very first instances of US subversion against a left-wing government in Latin America. This is one of the first instances. This predates the Cold War. So, you know, we often look at the dictatorships that came after the Cold War in South America, for example, and the Caribbean. But in Costa Rica, we saw the overthrow of a left-leaning regime, a left-wing populist regime, in the 1940s, as early as 1948.
And that was part one of the history of Costa Rica in Central America with Dr. Sasha Gillies-Lakakis. And on the program next week, part two.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.